From Maine to Montezuma and also across to Tripoli, this is Monitor with Alan Ludden sitting in for Al Capstaff here in Radio Central. Our advance intelligence from Chicago tells us that the New World today will really deal with a new world, one so remote at the moment from our world of political banter and international talks that only the scientists know its language and mysteries. Well, since the scientists are willing and ready to let us in on their trade secrets, let's see what we can learn by swinging our monitor microphone now in the direction of the University of Chicago and Professor Edward W. Rosenheim, Jr.
From this university's point of view, in the last 2 weeks, the most important and dramatic happening occurred not on campus, not in Washington or even Moscow, but 93 million miles away on the surface of the sun. A solar flare, or if you will, explosion, hurled forth the greatest shower of cosmic rays in recorded history. It was a memorable day for the university's scientists, and among these, none was more active than John A. Simpson, professor of physics in the Enrico Fermi Institute of Nuclear Studies, and a small research group which has been working with Professor Simpson. For this reason, our New World program today takes the form of a visit to Professor Simpson. It's been said, Mr. Simpson, that the scientists of the university flew into action like firemen of some sort on the occasion of this solar event. How did you actually find out what was happening on the sun?
You probably describe it rather accurately because for over 3 years we've been set up so that on call from an alarm system we would be able to go out and make some special measurements if such an event as happened last week should occur. As a matter of fact, we've designed automatic equipment which looks for incoming cosmic ray particles over and above the normal cosmic radiation that comes into us all throughout the periods of time, day and night. And if an excess of cosmic radiation should come, the apparatus thinks it over a little bit, computes out how much has come in, and if it's sufficient to interest us, then it closes a circuit, rings an alarm, and then we can go out and make the measurements we wish.
And that day last week, the circuit closed, the alarm rang, and you scampered out to Stagg Field, where men used to play football, sent up balloons, and engaged in a lot of other activities that I hope we can explore in this discussion today. But first of all, perhaps we ought to be fairly clear about what happened on the surface of the sun. We've heard it referred to as a solar flare. Exactly what was this occurrence?
For some period of time, about a period of 2 weeks or more, it's been known that the sun was beginning to show special regions of activity. These regions of activity are identified by the occurrence of large magnetic fields, extensive sunspots, which are the dark regions you can see on the sun if you look at them. And incidentally, these sunspots don't produce the event I'm talking about.
That's important to know because some people think they do.
Yes, they generally occur in the region or nearby the regions where the flares are produced, but they don't create the effect itself. Well, conditions were right for such an event, but it's just like throwing dice. You have to wait until statistically the event occurs, and then you see a large, what you might call explosion. Usually it's in the form of a large amount of light being emitted from a region very near the surface of the sun. Radio waves are emitted, and as we saw in this special case, cosmic rays were emitted.
As long as you've used the term cosmic rays, could you take a second to give us some idea of precisely what cosmic rays are?
Certainly. Let's take, for example, a charged particle. If we have the nucleus of a hydrogen atom and accelerate it to extremely high energy so that it's traveling with almost the velocity of light, we have a cosmic ray particle. In the last years, machines have now been able to reach energies which approximate the cosmic ray energies. In fact, they have energies equivalent to the low energy end of the cosmic ray spectrum. So cosmic ray particles are essentially the nuclei of atoms that have been accelerated to the point where they travel with almost the velocity of light. Not only protons, helium atoms, but even iron nuclei are accelerated.
In other words, a very simple statement is that they are enormously rapidly traveling atoms, is that it, or nuclei of atoms?
Yes, and therefore exceedingly energetic.
Well, now, precisely what was it that you were interested in on the occasion of this solar flare? What were you studying that made this event so extremely important?
For a number of years, we've been interested in the general question of the origin of the cosmic rays. First of all, how do they get these tremendous energies, energies which run up to 100,000 times that which we can produce on the Earth today? Where are they produced? These two questions are always in the forefront of any research activity that we have at present. However, we don't know the answers to these questions, but we do know that one of the minor sources is the sun itself. And so this particular event, the event of last week, in which cosmic ray particles were certainly produced, is interesting to us because it's an example. It's the one thing a scientist can measure. He knows something about the region in which it was generated, in which the cosmic rays were generated, and he knows the kinds of particles that arrived.
Well, to summarize then, the cosmic ray is... The cosmic rays are generated in a number of different places. You have no idea of the sources, really, but you do know that the sun, an occasion like this one last week, does generate them. You refer to it as a minor source. You have a specimen situation here, then, in which you can draw all kinds of inferences about cosmic rays that are generated elsewhere. Does that sum it up correctly?
Exactly. In fact, our best estimates at present would indicate that the sources of cosmic ray particles are to be found throughout the galaxy. And beyond that, I think we can't say much more.
I wonder if parenthetically I can engage in a habit we have once in a while here on this New World program, Mr. Simpson, and that is exploding a few false rumors. We do it as a kind of public service. One hears a good deal of talk that cosmic rays are harmful. Is this truth or nonsense?
I think that with the levels that we're talking about here, that nothing could be farther from the truth. As a matter of fact, why should we work so very hard to try and measure the events if they're obviously going to be easily detected and observable to the average individual? These things are quite elusive, require rather sophisticated instrumentation, and in no way will injure or or affect the lives of the individuals.
Well, that seems extremely sensible and very reassuring to know. Now, I know that you sent up a couple of balloons from Stagg Field at the time this occurred. Is it possible to explain the purpose of releasing these balloons in terms of the study that you're doing?
Generally, when one sets up apparatus to measure the possibility of an increase in cosmic ray intensity, you have the apparatus located at some point where it can remain for months or years at a time. Such locations are mountaintops and the surface of the building in which we're now operating. However, you also want to know what was going on outside our atmosphere. What was happening at the top, and how did it compare with what you saw at sea level? And so in order to relate these two, balloon flight is essential to carry instruments that measure all the way up to the top and back again to obtain the information that you need. In this way, one can tell what went on outside our own atmosphere.
So these balloons carried a variety of elaborate apparatus, I suppose.
Yes.
How did you manage to keep track of the balloons?
In general, we transmit all the information back by special radio receivers. All the information coming along the carrier of the radio signal itself. And so by the time the balloon flight is over, in case of radio transmission, we have all the information. On the second flight, where photographic emulsions were flown to capture the particle, so to speak, one has to get the emulsion back. And at the moment, we don't have these emulsions back in our hands.
In other words, one balloon still failed to return.
Yes.
Are you in hopes of its eventually landing someplace and having access to it?
We're sure that it's landed. The question is where.
Well, possibly radio can help us. If anybody's found a balloon in his front yard, return it to Dr. Simpson as soon as you can. Well, now, you've explained, I think, very interestingly, the particular interest which prompted you to study this solar event. Other kinds of scientists found it of equal importance, I suppose, didn't they?
Yes, I'm sure of this. We've really not had time to compare notes, but one can be certain that those interested in radio communications, those interested in studying the ionization of the outer regions of our atmosphere, the so-called ionosphere, those interested in studying the changes in the Earth's magnetic field, which produce magnetic storms, as well as other cosmic ray scientists, are all interested in this special event. And the knowledge of developments in these various fields will all go together in the long run, I'm sure, to give some practical applications, although that is not the objective of these researches, some practical applications by way of understanding better how radio communications work, what makes them fail, what are the problems associated with communications at very high frequencies.
Well, I know that you are very much interested in this whole problem of the relationship that exists between different kinds of scientists working on different kinds of problems and the way in which their material can be collected and coordinated. A good deal has been done in that direction, hasn't it? For example, even at this university, scientists of various kinds are engaged in working together in a rather nice cooperative way. Isn't that true?
Yes, you'll find in any basic research group in a university a diversity of interests, and many of them apparently isolated, but coming together at some interesting points. I'm sure that the meteorologists will have something to say about the influence of this event on their work, although it may not be very important. It may be of some specific interest. For example, our own research, we've tried to extend our measuring apparatus so as to cover a quadrant of the Earth. We have set up our own laboratories in Peru, Mexico City, New Mexico, Climax, Colorado, and then, of course, the station in Chicago.
These are all University of Chicago projects.
That's right, and we get the cooperation, for example, of the Magnetic Observatory in Peru and the University of Mexico in Mexico and the Air Force in New Mexico and the High Altitude Observatory in Colorado and so forth. You know that these facilities exist, and you set up your apparatus there, and you're able to set up a worldwide network which gives you all this information. However, you can only go so far. As you go farther north, you run into the problem that the mountains are always covered with snow, that you don't find observatories. So what we did at the university was to include jet aircraft at high altitude carrying the apparatus we want. This is in the past few years. We don't have them right now, in addition to the balloon flights. So you can cover up to the top of the atmosphere, you can cover from the equator towards the North Pole, and the reason for the latter measurements are simply to use the Earth's field as a sorter for the particles coming in, because particles that come in at the equator have to have higher energies than the particles that can come in at high latitudes. So one can tell, and we will be able to tell, from the solar event, roughly how many low-energy particles came in and how many high-energy particles came in.
Because this solar event was observed in almost every area in this great scientific spider web that you've just described. Is that right?
Yes. We're very lucky in one regard, that in having our laboratory on board one of the Antarctic vessels coming back from this recent Operation Deep Freeze, having the vessel in the harbor at Wellington. And Mr. Folkt on board ship has already measured the event, and we'll soon have the data. So that gives us a point in the southern hemisphere.
Well, now, as long as you are talking about these worldwide operations, Mr. Simpson, I think I'd like to exploit the occasion of this visit to ask you about something on which I think you can speak very authoritatively, and that is the coming International Geophysical Year, because it's very closely related to this whole problem of cooperation among scientists. I'm sure our listeners would be interested in learning that you are one of the two United States members of the Special Committee on the International Geophysical Year, and so you're perhaps as close to this really extraordinary project as anyone with whom we could talk. Could you take a moment or two to tell us about the Geophysical Year and what it is?
Yes, I'd be glad to. I think you can see from my previous remarks that in a university, and particularly in a private university, one can only expand to include so many stations and so many planes and so many facilities of whatever kind you want. It's based on the principle of a few individuals working together. For example, Dr. Meyer and I launched the balloon flights this past week, but aside from a small and devoted group such as we have, there isn't a large backlog of technicians and others available for carrying out extensive operations. So one has to look to other areas and the cooperation of scientists and observers in other parts of the world to extend work once you've made the initial steps towards understanding the event, such as the solar flare. Now, we know also that to make progress, one has to develop theories. And in the university, one tries to make theory and experiment go hand in hand. You do an experiment, you find some, you make some new discoveries, you find that this forms a framework. And within this framework of ideas, there are perhaps two or three possible explanations. The question is, which one is right? Well, after you've developed this theory, then you test it again by another experiment. This goes on and on, back and forth. Well, we come to the point where one has to introduce new features. For example, it may be that we would be interested in the radio noise coming from this sun, this solar flare event of last week. Well, if we are, certainly the university doesn't measure radio noise, but we know that radio noise is measured by other groups. And so if we have cooperation, it's possible to exchange data, get the radio noise, and to continue the research and explore these various possibilities. Now, for the IGY, which is the International Cooperative Program of Research and Observation among 40 nations in the world.
IGY stands for
International Geophysical Year.
Righto.
Right. We hope to achieve this for a period of 18 months. Cooperation in all fields of the Earth sciences and the solar, many areas of solar physics and cosmic rays. All boundaries essentially are dropped in order to exchange data.
You mean all national boundaries?
All national boundaries, essentially, from the point of view of exchanging data, are dropped. The scientists in country A will distribute to all the other 40-some nations the information that he's obtained on a particular event, and in turn, he will receive from all the other scientists any information he needs to carry out his research that may be related to his work, but maybe measurements he could not make himself.
When does this International Geophysical Year start?
This begins the 1st of July, 1957, a little over a year from now, and it's a very interesting year in that it's 18 months.
Where are the headquarters going to be? I suppose you must have a center of this vast network.
Well, the committee will set up perhaps two or three centers. In the meantime, the center is nominally in Belgium, and decisions in the distribution of data and the decisions for the organization of these centers is still to come. However, this should not be taken to indicate that things are in a preliminary stage, because many nations are already in the Antarctic setting up their laboratories for this forthcoming year, and the United States is one of these.
I understand that one of the features of this entire plan is that each nation will be dependent upon to contribute the thing which its scientists do best or are best equipped to do. Is that right, that there's some sort of real distribution of responsibility that way?
Yes, exactly. No nation is told what it must do. Each nation is asked to see what it can do. There's no exchange of funds from one nation to another. Each nation does what it can. The large nations are carrying the bulk of the program. Our committee, for example, the special committee for the IGY, recommended to the nations that satellites be established, for example. Now, among all those nations invited to establish satellite programs, only the USSR and the United States have come up with proposals. We hope that at least one other nation will, but this is an indication of the kind of cooperative effort. The large nations that can do big things will do big things. The small nations that can do very special and unique things, either because of their position or because of the special instruments they have, will do those things.
Is the committee of which you are a member in itself a widely international thing at this point?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, of a group of, I believe, 14, there are only two in the United States, Dr. Berkner at Brookhaven National Laboratories and myself here.
And then the rest of the committee is composed of people from European countries and
British, French, Russian, German, Italian, so forth.
And you get a similar diversity, not only an international diversity, but a diversity of scientific skills. That is, you will have meteorologists and physicists and chemists and all that sort of thing represented in the plan.
Yes, meteorology, specialists in magnetic field studies, specialists in the movement of continents, specialists in the oceans, the glaciers, as you said, the weather, all of these are going to be cooperating together, because it's quite clear that the indirect effect, for example, of solar energy coming to the Earth is to produce the melting and the freezing of the waters on the world, around the world, and in turn, this effect has a profound has profound consequences for the average farmer and for the average airline pilot.
I can imagine so. Well, we began with a very important event on the sun. I'm glad we've concluded with this very important future event among the scientists of this Earth. Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Simpson. Today's New World has taken the form of a visit with Professor John A. Simpson, physicist of the University of Chicago's Enrico Fermi Institute and a leading researcher in cosmic rays. May I take a moment to thank the many listeners who've responded to our invitation for suggestions as to topics that New World might explore. We continue to be eager for your ideas. Send your suggestions to New World, University of Chicago, Chicago 37, Illinois. That's New World, University of Chicago, Chicago 37, Illinois. This is Edward Rosenheim, returning you now to Monitor in Radio Central.
And that was The New World for today, a dip into the strange and fascinating orbit of science. Remember, if you have any subjects you'd like to be here discussed on these weekly adventures and ideas, send them to New World, University of Chicago, Chicago 37, Illinois. Maybe you'd like to hear about some special theory that helps to shape a new world.